You're listening to the 29th episode of the Armand and Kill Show, bringing you interviews with local activists, policy experts, and politicians from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Akhil Krishnan.
And I'm Armand Rana. It's the 14th of June, 2025 at 5.06 p.m. We are broadcasting live from UBC's Vancouver campus, located on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Han Kamina-speaking Musqueam people. So Akhil, how have you been?
I've been good. It's been a wild, hectic, unbelievably busy few weeks, personally, as well as just in the world. I mean, the conflicts in the Middle East are escalating.
So you're personally involved in the conflicts in the Middle East?
You have no idea. You know, the conflicts in the Middle East are escalating with a fresh exchange of missiles between Israel and Iran, against, of course, my advice to world leaders. A plane crash in India that left more than 260 people dead. A crackdown on protests in Los Angeles. You know, the crackdown is followed by the deployment of Marines in the city, which is not something you generally see in a mature democracy. A U.S. senator was forcibly removed from the press conference held by the Secretary of Homeland Security over there. And, you know, of course, back at home, the new Liberal government is moving quickly to pass a significant infrastructure bill and a defense bill. And even closer to home, the provincial BC government is passing renewable energy and infrastructure bills. Personally, I've been busy at work. There's been a lot going on that front. So all in all, I'd say it's been relatively uneventful, if I had to sum it up.
Yeah. And so just to clarify, you work as a advisor to both Iran and Israel in this ongoing conflict.
We're all in a group chat, and I just put my advice on there.
It's a signal chat.
Yeah, exactly. It's a signal chat, and you know, it's like people can take these tidbits if they want. You know, there's no pressure, man.
It's like Wikipedia.
Yeah. Supreme Leader, Prime Minister of Israel. You know, if you want to take it, take it. You know what I mean? Yeah, it's like a box of Timbits. I'll just put the box of Timbits there. If you want to take it, you can take it.
Yeah. But it doesn't seem to be super nutritious, this box of Timbits. Just the way
You know what they say, man. Wars are never
nutritious.
Yeah, they're never local, fresh, and nutritious.
Okay. What have you done for me lately, though, Akhil? What have you done for me?
Me? Without me, you would have lost the election. Dems would control the House, and the Republicans would be 51-49 in the Senate.
I would have won Pennsylvania regardless of you. I'm actually very disappointed in you, Akhil.
Such ingratitude.
You worked, you know, very hard at the Armand and Akhil show, and I think you missed this place. It's not just you. I think, you know, when some people leave, they miss it so badly they develop Armand Derangement Syndrome, ADS. Some embrace it, and some become hostile.
Okay, now you've done it, all right? Now it's time to drop the really big bomb. You're in the Epstein files. That is the real reason they have not been made public. Have a nice day, AR. Mark this post for the future. The truth will come out.
Okay, so that was just that was actually a transliteration of an exchange between Elon Musk and Trump. If you missed that, I am not in the Epstein files, just for future analyzers, consumers.
Do not mark it down for the future.
But I don't know if we could do true justice. So let's just kick things off by taking a listen to the Orange Man himself. Do you want to play that clip?
What happened with Elon? Is there anything that you can do to forgive him? Could you see that happening?
Well, I have no hard feelings. You know, I was really surprised that happened. He went after a bill that's phenomenal. It's the best thing we've ever signed in this country. And that's phase one, phase two, phase three. All of a sudden, is, you know, it all comes together. It's coming together so well. And when he did that, I was not a happy camper. So it's too bad.
You said he had problems. What kind of problems? I mean, is it the drugs?
I don't know what his problem is, really. I don't know. I haven't thought too much about him in the last little while. But the bill is so good. When he went after the bill, this bill is going to turn around this country so fast your head will spin. It's good for everyone. It's also a tax cut. It's a massive tax cut. It's an extension of debt, which we need. We have to get that. And then we're going to start paying off debt at record levels. It's tariffs on certain people. It's, by the way, no tax on tips, no tax on Social Security. You know,
all your promises.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's no tax on overtime. if a worker works overtime, there's no tax. That's going to be a great stimulant for the country. No, I think your bill is great. And
he just didn't
I think
get that.
He feels very badly that he said that, actually.
And maybe it was something else. I mean, he had the fight with Scott Bessent outside your office.
Yeah, well, they had not a fist fight, you know, people, but I guess they had a little bit of a shouting match. But that's
did you hear?
That's typical. I heard a little bit. That's sort of typical about, you know, that happens.
You were very kind to him. I saw you together, and I think he treated you a bit like a father. And
I was disappointed in him. But, you know, it is what it is that happens. Things like that happen. I don't blame him for anything. I was a little disappointed.
Could you reconcile?
Say it?
Could you reconcile with him, do you think? Could you forgive him?
I guess I could, but, you know, we have to straighten out the country.
Yeah.
And my sole function now is getting this country back to a level higher than it's ever been.
Got to take the country back higher than to a level that it's never been, you know?
Yeah, that was... What was your reaction to that?
I think what immediately occurs to me is that we all need a father figure like old Daddy Donnie here, you know?
Yeah, the interviewer herself was a bit odd.
Well, I mean... It was in the Sun. It's not exactly the most most reputable news outlet in the UK. Yeah.
But do you think they had a fatherly father-son dynamic? Is that how you kind of would describe it earlier when they were, you know, Trump was promoting his cars and stuff? Would you consider it a father-son?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say it's a father-son relationship, the same way that a teenager disrespects his father because he has blackmail on his father and his father's afraid of him. Yeah, I'd say that kind of father-son relationship, you could say. But I mean, like, look, when they had the meeting in the Oval Office a couple months ago now, back in happier times when they didn't need couples counseling, they did have this weird dynamic where Elon was seemed to be like dictating things of like what was going to happen with Doge and Trump was just like and maybe it was just his health failing because he's a very 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 old decrepit human being, but it's also like his kids just like sounded like his kid was telling Donald Trump to shut up. And I don't know.
Yeah, he got into a fight with Elon. All these weird clips of just like Trump and the kid together.
Yeah.
Like going from planes and
exactly.
Elon was nowhere in the picture. Exactly. He was like, he'd appointed Trump as like national babysitter for Elon's
exactly,
kids.
Yeah.
Which you definitely need because he just has so many of them.
No, but also
you need the U.S. president babysitting some of them.
Yes,
childcare services are tough, right?
So, yes, it is.
So you need to get your grandfather to your father your father figure. That's where I guess.
And you want a babysitter to be intimately familiar with how diapers work, and so.
No comment. So what else is our friend our. The most powerful man in the world doing at present. How is he occupying his time with all the crises, multitude crises?
Yeah,
facing the nation.
As you may or may not be aware, there is a military parade ongoing right now. I didn't know this until today, but that it's a 4-hour event. This whole like parade business is a 4-hour event. It started at I think 6 o'clock Eastern, and it's going to go on for another hour 45, and it has a country music concert and a speech by the president. It's just seems like a lot for what have they really done?
What I was just looking, you know, different countries have different kind of dynamics with these military parades, but I was looking into the U.S. historically, and it seems they generally do these parades once they've got a big military victory. Like the last time they had one was after the first Iraq war
in 1991, after Operation Desert Storm.
Yeah. But here, it's just like, they've just been taking the L for the last 20 years.
Exactly.
In every conflict they got involved in.
Yeah.
Trump came in, said he was going to create peace in Ukraine, create peace in Gaza. The Middle East has exploded. Ukraine is still in a worse situation than when he started. India and Pakistan have been fighting each other. He's threatened to invade Canada.
Yeah.
It just hasn't been a great success story, I would say, for U.S. Foreign policy or U.S. Defense on the world stage.
Yeah, when Donald Trump is president, every day is Taco Tuesday.
Yeah, yeah. Well, TACO, for our listeners, stands for Trump always chickens out. And so Akhil is trying to make a clever pun there.
Trying? I thought it was very successful.
Yeah, it was very clever. But yeah,
the silence is loud.
Yeah, I just think he just doesn't have the attention span for any of this stuff.
No, and he has been, even in that clip that we just heard, he is noticeably slurring some of his words. He's struggling to get through speeches. It's natural for someone who's 79 years old. He turned 79 today. It's a long time, right?
Yeah.
He was born a year after World War II ended. It's been a minute since this guy was born. So it's natural that he is getting older, and he's look, this is his way of staying out of jail, right, until he dies.
Yeah, I don't know what his motives are, but yeah, it seems, you know, the American people are very fascinating. They were like, "Oh, we don't like Biden, he's too old. So let's just elect someone who's, you know, a couple of years younger than him. That'll definitely work out this time."
Yeah.
But yeah, what else? What else is going on in the States?
Yeah, so the big story over the past week and a half has been the protests in California. California has the largest population of undocumented immigrants in terms of cities. Los Angeles has the largest population of undocumented immigrants of any city in the United States. And so there was a large-scale immigration crackdown that started about 10 days ago or so. And it's really set off a large response from the people in the form of demonstrations, et cetera. And honestly, the federal government's response was to almost immediately inflame the situation by threatening to federalize the National Guard, which they did end up doing. Right, they federalized the National Guard, sent them in. By which point, the LAPD had already been deployed en masse with riot gear, etc. And yeah, so there were a few Waymos that were burnt. There were significant arrests. Many arrests that were made, and it all culminated with the Marines being deployed to Los Angeles. And I think the big story 2 days ago was that they detained somebody, which was the first time the Marines had detained anyone on U.S. soil.
When was the last time like the U.S. Army was on deployed domestic soil? Is that Civil War or is it time after that?
Probably Civil War, no? Because after that, they were definitely after World War II, the only time they've been deployed, or like the talk of them being deployed, was during the Civil Rights Movement. But even then, they didn't end up getting deployed. It was all the National Guard who were being federalized and put in. Because there is the act, right? It's called Posse Comitatus, which puts significant limits on what the federal military can do in what their role is in domestic policy.
Yeah, yeah. So this is literally like crossing the Rubicon.
Exactly, yeah.
It's literally, yeah. It's like the definition of crossing the Rubicon.
That image of two Marines walking out of the federal building and detaining a black man it seemed like a watershed moment, right? Not unlike the photo of Ruby Bridges, not as significant, but you know, like those photos that could remain etched in history. But yeah, here's Trump talking about whether or not the Marines were going to be deployed to Los Angeles.
Are you planning to deploy Marines in California to address the situation in Los Angeles? Are you going to deploy Marines in California?
We'll see what happens. I mean, I think we have it very well under control. I think it would have been a very bad situation. It was heading in the wrong direction. It's now heading in the right direction. And we hope to have the support of Gavin, because Gavin's the big beneficiary as we straighten out his problems. I mean, his state is a mess. And I'd like to get somebody involved in the rail because, personally, it should have never been built, because you can fly there for $2, and what are you doing? They're doing that. You could drive. You could do lots of different things. You know, if they did a study, if you gave every passenger the finest limousine service in the history of our world, the most expensive chauffeur-driven white-glove limousine service back and forth, we would have saved billions of dollars as opposed to building this monstrosity that's going up. And I've never seen anything. You know, I've seen cost overruns. I'm a person. I've always done well on cost overruns. I don't have them. But I will tell you, I have never seen cost overruns. You see them where they're 20% more, 50%, 100% more. These are thousands of percent. Nobody even knows. They have no idea. And it was supposed to be from San Francisco to Los Angeles. Well, they just made it way outside of Los Angeles. Where it's stopping in the middle of, I don't want to say nowhere, because I happen to like one of those little cities very much. But it's way short of the destination. And our government is saying, you know, why are we involved in this thing? It's been handled so badly before him, but he really blew it. So, you know, all right, one more.
Yeah, so what do you think, Roman? Do you think the Marines being deployed was a huge problem because of the thousands of percentage more budget spent on the railway between San Francisco and Los Angeles? But it's not going to Los Angeles anymore. It's in the middle of nowhere. It's not really the middle of nowhere because I like those small towns. But, you know, it wasn't really Gavin, but it was before him. But he really blew it up. What do you think about that?
Yeah, yeah. I also was amazed at the cheap deals he has on plane flights that cost $2.
$2.
I was like, this is a great...
It's either the $2 flights or the white glove limousine service that you can get back and forth.
That's cheaper than building a train.
Yeah, cheaper than building a train. But it is the most supreme up there white glove limousine service in the history of the world.
Well, you know, so
even
given
more.
This context, you know, given this context that he's going to put this, you know, limousine service in place, I believe, and he's going to have these $2 airplanes, I'm now fully in favor of deploying the U.S. Marines wherever Trump wants to make that happen. These $2 plane flights, I just can't be beat. Like, I will lose my desire for democracy if somebody offers me $2 plane flights.
You were getting dangerously close to getting diagnosed with TDS right there, Trump derangement syndrome. So I'm glad you realized that $2 flights were good.
Yeah. No. It's I'm fully on board now.
You're fully
let's just start the Civil War.
You're fully on board, but not all aboard, because that's a train metaphor.
Okay.
And you're not about that, because you're not a socialist.
Yeah, clearly. Yeah, I'm fully on board the plane, the $2 plane.
Yeah. You know something that just in, you know, you said that the Americans are very interesting people because, you know, like that Biden is really old and then Trump, like you can hear in all these clips that this is an old gentleman. Sorry, I don't know if everyone agrees he's a gentleman, but he's like an old man, right? He's not a gentleman. He's an old man. You know, what's interesting is like Americans voted for this. It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? These guys will cut education, then Americans get less educated, and then they'll just buy whatever Fox News on. Do you think there's any way out of this cycle? Do you think you can build enough trains in order to get out of this, for them to get out of this?
Or planes.
Or $2 plane rides.
$2 plane lines, and then they just leave the country. The people who want to leave, you know, the scientists and all those people, I believe a lot of them are going to France and stuff because they've cut the funding.
Yeah.
So this will subsidize their exit. But yeah, in a more serious note, it is just so bizarre. I think people really need to think about what is the implications of having the U.S. Army on domestic soil, what that means. And I use the phrase crossing the Rubicon because when Julius Caesar crossed the Rubicon, the whole concept was that we were not supposed to bring the army into the civilian core of the Roman Empire, what became the Roman Empire, right? And this is exactly...
This is a situation where you can say this is literally like crossing the Rubicon,
yeah,
right?
So it after that, you know, Rome lost any, you know, notion of democratic or republican rule and became, you know, an empire with a, you know, an absolute leader and dictator. That was a, you know, very clear transition. And that's why we use that phrase today.
Yeah.
I think it's very concerning. It's probably, from a U.S. perspective, it's probably the most concerning thing that's come out of this last little while.
Yeah. And there doesn't seem to be this, the response here doesn't seem to rise to the level that it probably should, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, you have some people screaming at the top of their lungs, but this is in most other countries, like in Canada, if Mark Carney were to send someone to Vancouver because of a protest, send the Canadian military in, there would be a no confidence vote, and I'd hope that government would fall, right? And probably would.
Yeah.
But it's pretty, really doesn't seem to be dealt with the same level of seriousness that it probably should be.
Yeah. It's very It's very disturbing. And yeah, and it's just the other thing, I think there's this perception that California is some sense of failed state, or there's this like larger narrative that he's feeding into, and he talks about Gavin in kind of this like first name basis rather than Governor Newsom. But you know, the reality is, yes, California has a lot of problems, Gavin Newsom has a lot of problems. It would be one of the largest economies,
the fourth largest
the world if it was its own country. It is around the population of Canada, much larger economy, you know, huge number of the world's largest organizations are headquartered there.
It is an economic engine without which the American economy would not have its strength.
It's not a failed state that the rest of the states are trying to bail out in some way.
It is exactly the opposite.
It is, yeah. The economic relationship and even cultural relationship with Hollywood is kind of the inverse, right? Is that it is a very dominant, for better or for worse, economic, cultural, and, you know.
And fiscal entity, too.
Yeah.
Californians pay a lot of federal taxes that go everywhere else in their country. I mean, you have places like Arkansas or Mississippi that are very poor states that get federal dollars that California disproportionately contributes to.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not a failed state, even though they have security issues, they have all sorts of issues that we could go into at some point, but maybe not today. Do you want to take a break? We are at 5:30.
Let's do that. Let's take a break. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Armand Nikhil Show on CITR 101.9 FM. We're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to talk about domestic policy.
This is Alex Runyons. My new album, Above the Clouds and On the Ground, encompasses everything I love the most about making music. As a singer-songwriter, I am passionate about digging into the experiences of life and creating something with intention, meaning, and growth. While this album takes its inspiration from my own transformational experiences as of late, it's also for you. Life is hard. Hope is magical. Perspective allows us to balance both. With this album, my purpose is to lift people up into the clouds while keeping them grounded by what can be the harshness of reality. It's about humanity, hope, and healing. Above the Clouds and On the Ground is available wherever you love to listen to music. You can also visit alexrunyons.com. Funded by Factor and Canada's private radio broadcasters. That I was a king without a queen, a sun without a moon, a life without a dream. Yeah, that's me without you, a dusk without. This is Alex Runyons. My new album, Above the Clouds and On the Ground, encompasses everything I love about making music. I'm passionate about digging into the experiences of life and creating something with intention, meaning, and growth. Above the Clouds and On the Ground is about humanity, hope, and healing. Find it wherever you enjoy listening to music or visit alexrunyons.com. Funded by Factor and Canada's private radio broadcasters. That I was a king.
Join New Brunswick punk rockers Motherhood with special guests Montreal's Samoy and Vancouver's Space Crash Echoes June 11th at Green Auto. To get your tickets and learn more, visit at Green Auto Music on Instagram and click the link in bio.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Armand Nikhil Show on CITR 101.9 FM. We were discussing United States politics before the break, and now we're going to move on to Canadian politics. What's happening, Roman? Give us the rundown.
Yeah, so there is... Let's just start with Bill C-5. The intention of this bill is to remove federal interprovincial trade barriers and create a framework to fast-track infrastructure projects in Canada. I think people have heard a lot about the interprovincial trade barriers, so I'm not going to, you know, beat that horse to death. But let's talk about the infrastructure piece for a bit. There's a similar bill in the provincial government. Let's first take a listen to the clip, and then we'll just respond to that. It might provide some context.
For sure. Let's take a listen to this clip about Bill C-5.
Bill C-5, an act to enact the Free Trade and Labour Mobility in Canada Act and the Building Canada Act, be disposed...
Assistant Deputy Speaker John Nader gave notice Friday morning that the government plans to move the One Canadian Economy Act to third reading by next Friday. Intergovernmental Affairs Minister Dominic LeBlanc is the sponsor of the bill. He said U.S. President Donald Trump's tariff threats necessitate a tight timeline, but Indigenous rights will still be respected.
Every major project advanced through the changes proposed in Bill C-5 will require real partnerships with Indigenous peoples. We've already announced that we're setting up an Indigenous Advisory Council. We will ensure that self-determination, inclusion, and respect are at the heart of this process.
The legislation does a number of things, including giving the government the ability to fast-track energy pipelines. By streamlining the approval process through one office and reducing the time frame to do this from 5 to 2 years. But the Assembly of First Nations says things are moving too fast and the Liberals need to take the necessary time to do proper consultations. Bloc Québécois MP Sebastian Lemire pressed the government on how quickly the legislation is moving.
Indigenous people are being called on to play ball. And when you're given 5 days to study a bill, and when you're saying that we consulted the First Nations, in my mind, that's not consultation. Not each First Nation was not consulted.
In response, LeBlanc reassured that consultations will take place, but only after a project of national interest is chosen.
And then would allow the government and the private sector to conduct exactly that in-depth consultation. So here we're talking about, we're currently building something, but before a project is designated or approved, obviously those consultations will take place.
Speaking to media outside the House of Commons on Friday, Bloc Québécois leader François Blanchet said the government is massively increasing its powers while subverting parliamentary process at the same time.
How could we go forward with such a huge bill, with huge consequences for Quebec and Canada, without at least do what we have been elected to do? And that means studying thoroughly this bill in committee. The government seems to want to avoid scrutiny on the bill.
The AFN is set to host a virtual meeting on C-5 with First Nations leaders from across the country on Monday. As well, debate will continue on the proposed legislation the same day. Fraser Needham, APTN National News, Ottawa.
And before we discuss, I also want to read a bit about the Bill 15 and Bill 14, which are provincial acts and also fast-tracked acts. So this is the CBC reporting from about a couple of weeks ago. The BC NDP government narrowly passed two controversial laws that will fast-track infrastructure and clean energy projects. Bill 15, the Infrastructure Projects Act, is aimed at fast-tracking public sector projects like schools and hospitals, as well as private projects such as critical mineral mines that are deemed provincially significant. Bill 14, the Renewable Energy Projects Act, will speed up clean energy projects across the province. The BC Conservatives, BC Greens, and three formerly independent MLAs voted against the bill, while Speaker Rod Johan cast a tie-breaking vote in favor, allowing them to pass third reading on Wednesday. The bills are expected to receive royal assent on Thursday. Both bills have faced intense backlash from several First Nations leaders, environmental groups, and the Union of BC Municipalities, which say the give the government the push to push through research projects with limited consultation. Bill 15 is not just legislation, it's a test of the province's integrity. SARLP Chief Don Tom told the CBC after the bill is passed, either the government lives up to its reconciliation commitments or exposes them as empty words. You have the former NDP cabinet minister, Melanie Mark, the first First Nations woman to serve in the BC legislature, also came out against the bill. The BC Chamber of Commerce had its voice to opposition to the bill. From the business community's perspective, the decision has unintentionally heightened instead of diminishing uncertainty. It also criticized the province's decision to exclude pipelines and LNG facilities from the projects that could be deemed provincially significant, calling it arbitrary and short-sighted. EB said the legislation is a fork in the road between court and litigation fighting and between corporations' shared prosperity. Infrastructure Minister Bowen Ma said there more work needs to be done to establish minimum eligibility criteria for what could be deemed a provincially significant project. And finally, I want to just mention this. One First Nations group, the Nisga'a-Lisims government in Northwest BC, came out in support of the bills, given the economic uncertainty introduced by the new trade policies of the United States. NLG fully understands the need for British Columbia to move swiftly on these matters and is well placed to provide meaningful input in expedited circumstances, the nation wrote. The First Nation says it has been advocating for a more efficient and effective regulatory regime for some time now and has valuable input based on our ongoing experiences through various regulatory processes. So, yeah, well, maybe what was your reaction to this, Akhil?
There is a bottleneck in how projects get approved in this country. I think it's a problem in many major democracies where there is a rule by committee, and it's not an effective way to pursue major policy changes. But there's a reason why it's slow, right? There's a reason why we want to be deliberate with how these projects get approved. But at the same time, this is not exactly the time to be super deliberate about every single thing. Like, you want to be intentional about the changes you're making and how it'll affect your constituency. But you also have somebody on the other side, it's Donald Trump, who is moving fast and breaking things. And he's threatening Canada's sovereignty, he's threatening Canada's economy, he's threatening Canadian people's livelihoods. So I understand why the government is doing this. I support the need to be quick about this. But, you know, there's a reason why we have other parliamentarians, right? Their role is to push back. Their role is to be on their toes. If you've got 5 days to read a bill, if they're somehow still passing it, then you got to stay up as long as you need to. You and your staff need to stay up in order to get it done, right? That's politics. That's governance, is that you need to move as fast as you need to in order to get what your constituency needs done. So we can't operate with a set of rules that are so far divorced from reality where we can't say, well, this is going to take us 24 months to review and approve when the administration on the other side is saying we'll wreck the economy in 6 months, right? So I can see where the pushback is coming from, but there's a reason why this bill – They're touting this bill as the bill that's going to make Canada a superpower. I think that's overblown. But definitely, the Canadian economy has a significant productivity problem. And this is going to go a long way in addressing that. So I think it'll bear some good fruit.
Yeah, I think I come at it from a slightly different perspective. I think for me, especially the provincial bill aspect of it, of, you know, building schools, building hospitals, we saw, you know, during the last big, you know, immigration wave over the last few years, that our province was not, and our cities, whatever, they weren't able to build these facilities at the speed that demand increased. And the consequences of that on a community are very dire. That if you know, if you don't build hospital capacity at a sufficient rate, if you don't build increased schooling capacity, both of those things and essential services like that, if you don't build that capacity, could have very negative consequences. So I think that is a real problem that we need to address. You know, in addition to these kind of more broader questions about how we respond to U.S. tariffs, just this very kind of internal problem of, you know, we got a bunch of immigrants coming in and we just weren't able to scale out fast enough. There is an optimistic view and a pessimistic view of how these bills play out. If they're actually able to kind of streamline processes, you know, instead of having a million different smaller municipalities figure out how they get their schools built, you know, we have a kind of standardized process across the province in building a school. It's not rocket science to build a school anymore. Maybe, you know, 100 or so years ago, you would need some more caution in building a school. But now we built so many schools, it should not be something that we need to reinvent every time we build a new school. There should be a standardized process, a kind of prefabricated process that we can follow. So that's the optimistic side. The pessimistic side is, you know, this is adding another layer that, you know, the intention is to make it go faster, but in practice, it may actually make things go slower. And that's my one concern. And then also just the process in which this bill was enacted. I don't know if it was malice or there's some intent here where they do want to sidestep First Nations groups, or whether it was just incompetence, that they didn't follow the agreed upon processes in terms of UNDRIP and stuff, in terms of engaging First Nations groups at the provincial level. So that's kind of where my concerns are with this bill. And then federally, I think your analysis is more similar to mine, I think, in terms of, Trump is there. I think people don't realize the damage Trump's already done to our economy, unless you're in the line of work that's directly impacted. But, you know, basically our economy is in a recession now.
And there's a lag time, right? For things like jobs numbers, there's a lag time. We're seeing it crop up now. But these aren't things, like you said, unless you are in the auto industry, unless you are in mining in certain specific niches, you are not going to feel it right away. So you might not see it at the grocery store and wonder, or at the gas station and wonder, well, I'm hearing all of this happening in the news, but how is it actually impacting my life? Maybe this is all overblown. And 2-3 months down the road, the jobs numbers come out and you're able to see it there, or you're able to actually start seeing the impacts, right, in the fact that the economy is in recession. So, you know, there's a creep to these things.
Yeah. It's if you look every time the numbers come out, we export 70% of our exports to the U.S. or something. And every month there's a reduction in exports to the U.S. And there's an increase in exports to other countries, but it's not offsetting the decrease in the U.S. So, again, this is a real problem. Whether these bills are the solution, that's a different question. But for those, who are taking the position that, we don't need these bills or whatever, that's a valid position, totally for it. You have the right to the position. But I would like to hear, what are your alternatives to address these real problems, right? And there may be better alternatives. I'm not precluding that possibility. I think that's sometimes what's missing in some of these discussions is, I understand from a First Nations group perspective, if they're feeling that precedent is being set, they need to oppose it. But I'm just saying for arbitrary citizens, a random citizen on the street, in your mind, if you're thinking, hey, this bill is a bad idea, I'm not comfortable with, the state having this kind of authority or this kind of power, that's fine, it's valid. But we're in the situation, things are not looking great. How are we actually going to combat that? Yeah. What's the actual game plan here?
And it's happening now,
yeah.
Right? It's not. It's not a year down the road. It's not 6 months. It's happening. It's happened already. I don't think it's happening now. It's like, yeah, I think it's happened already. So, and the conversation about like what is the alternative? What is your solution? Needs to happen now. So even the opposition parties, right, in parliament, this is what they need to think about is, like, if you want to tell the Canadian people that this is the wrong way, give them an alternative to fall behind, right, and to support. Just saying no, like, you know, axe the tax. Like, this is, yeah, that's great. Like, but it doesn't, it's not a, a concrete policy prescription.
Yeah.
And that's what we need right now.
And then specifically, this is, so there's a broader conversation about, especially it's very U.S. focused conversation about so-called abundance agenda, which has been promoted by Ezra Klein, the contributor on the New York Times podcast. But, you know, his whole philosophy is that in the United States and Western countries, these over time, this regulatory regime has emerged that actually prevents a politician who's elected from increasing state capacity and making the state more effective, more efficient, more streamlined. And, you know, his view is that not just from a policy perspective, that even from a political perspective, that should be what the Democrats campaign on in the future. I'm not sure if I drink all of that Kool-Aid, but there's a reason why these sort of set of ideas have emerged in different levels of government in different countries around this time. Because David Eby got in 2-3 years ago with 2 years left in his mandate. He thought, I'm going to spend a lot of money, take a lot of deficit, build a lot of great infrastructure, and people are going to vote for me. What ended up happening is that he wasn't able to build infrastructure at a rate that kept up with the demand. And people actually felt that there wasn't a lot of show for all the money he spent. Similarly, in the United States, under Joe Biden, he had all those, you know, wonderful bills, Inflation Reduction Act, American Rescue Plan, etc., etc. Some of that money, you know, in terms of direct payments, okay, people felt that. But some of the money that was spent in infrastructure, again, it didn't really trickle down. People didn't really feel. A lot of money has, what we're finding out in the Trump administration, a lot of that money in the Inflation Reduction Act has not yet been spent because of these regulatory hurdles to actually getting the money out the door. So this is a challenge that multiple Western democratic countries are coming to terms with their own government around the world. And these bills are not necessarily the solution to the problem or a unique solution. But I think what's important for people to take away is this is both of these problems, whether it's Trump causing chaos for us in terms of tariffing our goods, or whether it's about our inability to build schools and hospitals quickly, let alone strategic national projects that help us diversify from the United States. These are real problems that we need to think about.
And in some ways, these problems always needed urgency to deal with, and we're just pushed to do it now. That's all. I mean, like, no country should have such significant internal barriers. Like, it's not a prescription for a successful economy, right? Long term, because you have no option but to rely on somebody else's good graces. If you have such significant trade barriers that each and every province doesn't even trade with each other more than they do with anyone else. So yeah, I think that if there's something that we take away from this long term, is that if we can eliminate that, I think we'll almost automatically have a much stronger economy than we would have otherwise. And we have to weather this. And some of these bills are going in the right direction.
Yeah, and the last thing I will say on this, which is slightly tangential, is there's been a lot of talk about, you know, Carney and Daniel Smith want to push through a bitumen pipeline through BC. It's not directly related to any of these bills, from what I understand. At least none of the BC bills allow for their use in oil pipelines. The Bill C-5 can be used for oil pipelines. The language that's used, that Carney uses, is a carbon neutral bitumen pipeline. That, I think, is a contradictory statement, and I just wanted to mention that. There are a lot of concerns amongst First Nations groups in the specific area, historically, in northern BC, where previous pipelines, Northern Gateway, had been proposed, and that's where the tanker ban came from. I think it's going to be a very tough sell to push through that pipeline. David Eby has so far indicated his government would not be supportive of it. We'll see how it goes. I don't think necessarily it's a terrible thing in general to export, help Alberta export more of their oil in this kind of situation. Maybe they need to look at ways to expand TMX or something. I just think it's not, it's just going to be a very tough sell to get that pipeline, given the history of pipeline politics in BC. I think getting that Northern Gateway pipeline through that region of BC is going to be very hard. And I think calling it a carbon neutral bitumen pipeline is fooling nobody. And I think may indicate some level of naivete of this new administration.
Sounds like you're somebody who in high school didn't like the term clean coal.
Yeah, well, clean coal, I actually prefer that. But carbon neutral bitumen pipeline is just beyond the pale. But yeah, let's move on. We don't have a ton of time.
Why don't you give us a lowdown on 1BC? Actually, you know what? Let's dive right in. Let's take a listen to this, shall we?
Yeah, let's do it.
Lower taxes, taking away teachers' right to strike, a crackdown on so-called mass immigration, and an end to BC's, quote, reconciliation industry. These are a few of the policy planks of a new political party called 1BC, formed by two of the three independent MLAs.
Hunger out there for the policies that the BC Conservative Party initially put forward and we all ran on.
Dallas Brody is the interim leader. Tara Armstrong is the House leader.
That we've got people, the base, disillusioned with what's happening with that party.
Absent from the ticket is the third independent MLA, Jordan Keeley.
There was a disagreement in what our perspectives were, and I think that's one of the reasons why I asked to just have more time to think about things.
The party registered with Elections BC on Monday. The party sent an email in an attempt to poach some BC Conservative MLAs. So far, none have taken the bait. Here's how we got here. In March, Brody was kicked out of the Conservative caucus over comments which leader John Rustad said mocked residential school survivors. Armstrong and Keeley left in solidarity, accusing Rustad of diluting Conservative values. Since then, the three independents have called for the repeal of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and pushed for an end to sexual orientation and gender identity, or SOGI, policies in schools. Forming an official party gives the two MLAs a pay raise for party leader and House leader. Also, funding for caucus staff and more opportunities to ask questions in the legislature. Rustad declined to comment on Thursday.
Yeah, this is the new party of the, so, you know, John Rustad formed this party after being thrown out of the former BC Liberals. He started, you know, he became leader of this party, the BC Conservatives, and then these guys were thrown out of that, right? And they weren't even able, the three of them, Dallas Brody was thrown out, and then two others left, Jordan Keeley and Armstrong. The three of them weren't even able to agree on a common platform. So now there are only two left. It's a circle of right-wing politics in Canada and BC. They just seem to be always churning, creating new splinter groups, recreating themselves. It's kind of bizarre.
Sounds like
to
a
watch.
Neat grift, though. Get a pay raise.
Yeah.
Be a two-person party.
Yeah.
This is like the times you hear when people from really, really small schools go like, I was valedictorian. How big was your class? Oh, there were three people in my class.
But. Yeah, yeah. When they call themselves house leader or whatever, it's just bizarre. If you go to their website, their policy proposals are very fascinating. One of them is an immediate 50% cut on income tax under $100,000. And a 25% cut on all personal corporate income. This would be a huge blow to provincial coffers. I don't think people realize, you know, how much, you know, income taxes is the primary source of revenue for the province. And
so you mean that they haven't actually seen haven't seen a provincial budget?
Yeah, and then they also want to end the government's deadly healthcare monopoly and give every British Columbian the option to purchase private health insurance, which violates the Canada Health Act.
Yes.
and I'm not sure many people will be pumped to transition to a private healthcare system in Canada. I never knew, realized it was so deadly. The other thing I wanted to point out is they have these kind of profiles on the website. I think everyone should check it out. It's 1bc.ca with the number 1. And part of the profile for Tara Armstrong reads, She has set herself apart in the legislature as one of the sharpest critics of the government, including the NDP's radical gender ideology and Premier David Eby's ties to communist China. Dum, dum, dum. So she has got the smoking gun that David Eby is actually apparatchik of the Chinese Communist Party. The last thing I wanted to mention on their website is they want to lower the threshold for recalling MLAs, which I think is potentially a dangerous move for Dallas Brody, because I don't think she's super popular in her riding right now. So she may want to reconsider that.
So she hasn't seen the provincial budget, or she hasn't, and she hasn't seen recent polling in her district, I guess.
Any other talks on 1BC?
I mean, any more thoughts that I have would have more thoughts than these guys put into forming their own party or their platform. So I'll leave it at that. But I think before we close it off, we do have to, I think the one thing that we do want to address is the significant escalation of tensions in the Middle East.
Yeah, let's not play the clip. We'll just talk
about
it.
There have been a significant escalation of tensions in the Middle East. Israel did launch a number of missiles a couple of days ago into Iran, killing a number of top commanders and nuclear scientists. One of the person that I thought was most interesting that they killed. I don't know what the most appropriate term is here. Assassinated, killed, was. The guy who is leading the nuclear talks with the United States. That was a very, like, you know, them killing the leader of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which they did, was a military move. Them killing other commanders and military moves. Them killing the guy leading the talks with the United States, their most significant ally and their largest defense partner, is an interesting move. Yeah. And, you know, in terms of Donald Trump saying, you know, that they have significant respect in the world, that Iran needs to make a deal now or it's going to get worse. Like, yeah, the guy who was discussing making a deal with you is now dead because the country that you supported in the Middle East just assassinated him.
Yeah. Yeah, I think one thing that people who are listening should think about is, or just be aware of, is, you know, this is a move by Israel because they sense weakness. They sense that Iran is collapsing. If you talk to people who are from that part of the world, they'll tell you that Iran is collapsing. You know, there's a power struggle. The supreme leader is very old and sick. They lost control of Syria. Israel took out Hezbollah. Hamas are also a shadow of their former selves. So a lot of the key Iranian proxies and allies in the region, they've lost control over them. They had that huge domestic upswell about the wearing of the woman's headdress a couple of years ago that lost any remaining semblance of kind of a moral authority over their own country. And so they're negotiating from a place of weakness. And I think Israel sees this as an opportunity to take out their, what they view as their largest regional rival. So I think that's the kind of the main framework to kind of view this in. I think people can get a bit caught up in, you know, other, you know, Israel-Palestine politics and maybe not see the wood for the trees here. But that's actually what appears to be happening.
That's why they're also targeting Iran's, literally a lifeblood of Iran's economy right now, right, is the oil and gas industry in Iran. And they are targeting those facilities too. As our kind of final nail in the coffin.
And the reality, like, Israel always makes it appear that Iran is 1 week away from developing a nuclear bomb. Iran is 1 week away. That they've made this argument for the last 10 years.
Yeah, we all remember the photograph of one of those Tom and Jerry bombs with 97% written on it that Netanyahu brought to the U.S.
Yeah, that was like over a decade ago. So, you know, don't believe the hype about that. The reality is Israel is sensing weakness, closing in for the kill. Iran has given a very, you know, powerful response in some ways, but this is, they're fighting for their life at this point as a state, and that's why their response has been so fulsome.
All right, I think we'll end it there. A few other things to wrap up. You can find us at The Armand Akil on Instagram and Twitter, so check us out there. If you like the show, please leave us a review on Spotify. The music for the show is composed with the wondrous musical talents of Sarah Pratt. Every note she writes is an exuberant gift to humanity, elevating our souls to incredible heights we never knew existed.
We do have some awesome shows with sets of guests lined up for you. Do continue to listen and subscribe. You can find all of our episodes on our podcast feeds. Do check them out. And have a great night and a great weekend.